Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Daniel Ellsberg, a former U.S. government employee who released the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War. He explains why he and others are calling for current government officials to reveal how the Bush administration misled the nation on the war in Iraq. David Cadman, deputy mayor of the city of Vancouver, British Columbia, who talks about how much of the world views the United States after the Bush administration's invasion and occupation of Iraq. And Sharon Lettman, deputy field director with People for the American Way, who explains preparations being made in Florida and across the nation to ensure that every vote is counted in November's presidential election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The worldwide revulsion felt over the murder by Chechen separatists of more than 300 Russians, including many children in the rural town of Beslan, has led several Arab leaders to condemn the killing of innocent civilians. One of the most pointed comments comes from Abdelrahman al-Rashed, the general manager of Al Arabiya, one of two major Arab satellite news channels. In a September 5th opinion article looking at the recent wave of attacks on civilians in Russia and the Middle East, Rashed wrote, "What an abominable achievement. Does this tell us anything about ourselves, our society, our culture?" Among elite circles, there is growing criticism of radical clerics and the fatwas or edicts they issue endorsing violence, according to the Christian Science Monitor. Rashed of Al Arabiya attacked the rhetoric of Egyptian Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who has a reputation as a moderate in some Western quarters. Yet Rashed defends suicide bombers in Israel and the killing of civilians in Iraq by militant groups. But there are many Arab commentators who defend terrorist acts, especially in relation to Israel and Iraq. Egyptian writer Fahmi Hawidi, an Islamist, noted that Russian troops have committed worse atrocities than inflicted by Chechen rebels. He said, quote, "I can understand why this happened. This did not happen because they were Muslims, but because they were driven mad." The Bush administration originally set aside $24 billion to rebuild Iraq's sewage treatment plants, the electric grid, and to purify drinking water. Yet only $5 billion had been spent by the end of June when the Coalition Provisional Authority was disbanded. The CPA had only created 10% of the jobs that it promised for Iraqi workers. Along the Tigris River in Baghdad, two major sewage treatment plants have been closed since April 2003. Every day since, a load of 780,000 cubic yards of human and industrial waste, including toxic chemicals, spews into the river. Meanwhile, local farmers say their drinking wells have been contaminated. Yet there is little visible work to fix the sewage treatment plants. The Bechtel Corporation, which has a lucrative $2.8 billion infrastructure contract, is far behind in making repairs. As retired engineer Ghazwan Mukhtar insists, Bechtel must learn to trust the Iraqis who worked on the power and water plants for the last 20 years. They know the quirks, he said, but the foreign contractors ignore the Iraqis, and as a result, they get nowhere. Notwithstanding the lack of progress, on September 14th, President Bush proposed to shift $3.46 billion of funds earmarked for Iraqi reconstruction to Iraqi security, oil production, and elections. In the late 1980s, the anti-environmental wise use movement sprang up in many Western states, with periodic violent threats against federal management of natural resources and to intimidate local grassroots environmentalists. Wise use waned after militia group members Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols bombed the federal building in Oklahoma City in 1995. According to Sierra Magazine, the wise use crowd flexed its muscle early in the Bush administration by axing the Interior Secretary nomination of John Turner, a friend of Dick Cheney who was the former director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the president of the Conservation Fund. Under fire from wise use groups, the Turner nomination was quickly pulled, and Gail Norton, an associate of James Watt, was nominated instead. This spring, the same wise use groups rose up again to block ratification of the Law of the Seas Treaty that had the backing of the U.S. Navy, major oil companies, and the Bush White House. Behind the organization called Sovereignty International, the wise use activists charged that the international treaty might set up a United Nations Navy that would threaten American global interests. Eventually, the right-wing campaign created enough heat in the U.S. Senate that Majority Leader Bill Frist delayed a vote on the treaty until after the November 2nd presidential election. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
More than 1,000 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq as deepening chaos and violence claim tens of thousands of Iraqi victims. Now, a group of former FBI, CIA, State Department, and Pentagon officials are calling on current government employees to come forward and reveal classified information regarding the Bush administration's Iraq war plans and the estimated costs of the conflict that contradict public statements made by the White House. The group, which includes FBI Special Agent and whistleblower Colleen Rowley, former FBI translator Sybil Edmonds, retired U.S. Army Colonel and Foreign Service Officer Ann Wright, and Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst for 27 years, warns that, like during the Vietnam War, the failure to publicly disclose government deceptions and cover-ups about the projected cost of the Iraq War carries with it a significant price in human life and national security. The signatories state that truth-telling is a patriotic duty and an effective way to serve the nation. Daniel Ellsberg was a career U.S. government political analyst when in 1971 he leaked the now famous Pentagon Papers to the press. The 47-volume Defense Department internal study of the U.S. role in Southeast Asian conflicts over three decades was classified top secret. The documents chronicled the lies and deceit employed by government officials to justify U.S. military intervention in the region's wars. Mr. Ellsberg, originally a strong supporter of the Vietnam War, became a committed opponent, risking his career and freedom when he released these documents to the New York Times. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Daniel Ellsberg about his group's call for whistleblowers to come forward to reveal how the Bush administration has misled the nation on the war in Iraq.
Some of us signed a call for patriotic truth-telling. What we were asking people to do was to put out to the public information on government lies, crimes, manipulation, violations of the Constitution, for instance, the war powers, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which was flagrantly abused or ignored by the Congress, as well as the President getting us into Iraq. The Congress delegated their powers in a way that the Constitution does not provide for, and which there was one very clear precedent for, and that was the Tonkin Gulf Resolution of just 40 years ago this year. Not a very good precedent. And the results are very similar now, that we've been lied into a wrongful, unnecessary, hopeless war. And people who see it in those terms in the government, and I'm sure there are hundreds, if not thousands of them, we're urging to consider doing what I wish I'd done much earlier than I did. I did put out thousands of pages of truthful classified documents, classified top secret, the history of the Vietnam War, so-called Pentagon Papers. I did that to the Senate in 69, and they really sat on it and did nothing with it. Then I eventually gave it to the newspapers. And what we're saying now is that don't wait as long as I did. Don't wait till bombs are falling. Don't wait till next war has started before telling the truth.
As you look at the current conflict in Iraq, with, it seems, accelerating numbers of attacks against U.S. forces and allies, what is the urgency and what is the comparison in your mind?
Well, the urgency right now is twofold. First, there's the day-to-day fact of lives being lost and wasted, lives that Americans are giving their own lives and are taking wrongly of innocent civilians in many cases, and even the people they're fighting are fighting an illegal occupation, and it's hard to call what they're doing illegitimate, even when the means they use are atrocities, often atrocious, terrorist. And I don't accept the idea that there's any justification for the deliberate killing of innocent civilians or noncombatants. Certainly the resistance there to our presence is doing that, just as the Viet Cong did do it in Vietnam. But that terrorism did not justify our occupation of their country, and it didn't justify the killing that we're doing. So there's the first great similarity, that in both cases we were in a country that we had no business killing people in, a country that had not attacked us, and that we had no right to occupy or to govern. That's true now in Iraq. A difference now is that our occupation of Iraq threatens Americans at home in a way that was not true during Vietnam, because the NLF did not undertake terrorism in the United States in response to our presence there. Now, Iraq had not been in any way a terrorist threat to the United States before our invasion, but I would say that recruits to al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden can be expected to flow from Iraq now, as well as from Saudi Arabia and from other countries where our presence, our armed presence, was resented, which was a major factor in Osama's unjustified terrorist response. Murder can have explanations even where it does not have justification. And our policies in the Middle East and elsewhere certainly have resulted in a violent response. We will not pacify Iraq any more than we ever had a chance of pacifying Vietnam. And by that term, I mean we will not succeed in achieving a nonviolent acceptance of our presence there and of our armed troops and of our bases and of our running the country, essentially, or determining who the country is. I don't think that will be accepted. And the meaning of that is that Americans will be dying and killing in Iraq just so long as they are there, as they're occupying, just as that was true in Vietnam.
Daniel Ellsberg, if you would just tell us a little bit about the risks that employees inside the government are taking in revealing certain of these documents that you're suggesting they do. You were prosecuted.
It's worth mentioning that I was the first person ever prosecuted for giving information to the American public. There's been exactly one since for leaking classified documents. That was Samuel Loring Morrison in 1985. So there is a danger of prosecution and even of conviction and prison time. You are risking the loss of your job, your access, your image, your career, your livelihood. And these are very serious costs. But we're talking now about issues of war and peace. And when one considers the courage that we're asking of young men and women, 140,000 of them, every hour of the day, every day, then I think that the government officials who understand that and understand their own complicity in it should be willing to take some risk.
Daniel Ellsberg, is one of the goals here to have this material, the documents, and proof of government malfeasance released before the November election? Is that one of your goals?
Yes, that's another reason for urgency. I mentioned two reasons earlier, and one is, of course, the fact that from day to day there is an urgency about saving lives. They're trying to tell the truth about this war and change the environment. I do think that the public deserves all this information before they go to the polls this time. So the fact that people can release information that is highly relevant to voters puts on them, I think, a responsibility and a challenge to act now and tell the truth now, not wait 4 to 6 months before they do it.
That was Daniel Ellsberg, whose release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971 bolstered public opposition to the Vietnam War. Get more information on the call for government whistleblowers by visiting Ellsberg's website at www.truthtellingproject.org. From September 9th through the 11th, New Haven, Connecticut hosted the 17th Annual Assembly of the International Association of Peace Messenger Cities. About 90 cities have been recognized by the United Nations Secretary General for excellence in working for peace. These cities have undertaken projects ranging from including a peace curricula in their schools to fighting Star Wars, the Reagan-era missile shield proposal that has been resurrected by President George W. Bush. The focus of this year's assembly is the abolition of nuclear weapons. One of the attendees at the assembly was David Cadman, deputy mayor of the city of Vancouver, British Columbia. His city is at the forefront in working for peaceful settlement of conflicts, dedicating resources to human development, and establishing alternatives to incarceration. Cadman was at the founding conference of the Peace Messenger Cities in 1989 and spends a lot of his time traveling the world to attend peace conferences. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with David Cadman on a bus from New Haven to New York, where delegates to the conference visited the United Nations and attended forums on the UN's role in peace and development. He discusses an outsider's view of the United States after the Bush administration's invasion and occupation of Iraq and some of the peace projects his city has undertaken.
Well, I think most people feel that the United States is becoming belligerent and no longer participating in the world community. They are going it alone, and that's been accentuated since September the 11th, where they feel that they can do whatever they want, wherever they want, regardless of the international body politic and what the international community thinks. And I think as a consequence, America is alienating itself from the global community. I find, certainly as Canadians, we're appalled at the kind of positions that the Americans have taken. I've been just in Europe, and the Europeans are appalled. My friends in Latin America and Africa can't believe that in the 21st century, that a leading superpower is so unsophisticated as to believe that they can go it alone.
So obviously this isn't a domestic issue so much in Canada if people are opposed to the war, but the government's also opposed to the war. But have there been any public expressions of anti-war sentiment?
Yeah, no, in Vancouver there's a weekly demonstration in opposition to the war in Iraq. There was a march April 22nd or something like that. It was coordinated, and there were 75,000 people out to that. Canada basically believes in working within the UN framework. And when the Americans say, we're not going to work within the UN framework, then at that point Canada says, well, you're on your own then. We're not going to go with you. I think clearly this was a case where we thought that Hans Blix was getting to the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and that was going to interrupt the ability of the Bush administration to do what they wanted to do and what they wanted to do since they got elected, which was to go in and get rid of Saddam Hussein.
Do Canadians believe there's any connection between 9/11 and Iraq and Saddam Hussein?
No, none. They know perfectly well that there was absolutely no connection there. What is appalling to us, in fact, is to look at the American media and the way it deceives the American people, and that the American people, for an international superpower, are, quite frankly, some of the dumbest people on international relations that I know of.
Dumb, you could say, or you mean by dumb, ignorant, because people just have no clue.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're uninformed, and the world is seen through a very narrow telescope that focuses solely on American issues and doesn't look at the larger international context within which they're operating.
What do you see as the value of the peace messenger cities?
Well, I think both the Mayors for Peace and the peace messenger cities are the locus now of where people live. 50% of the world's people live in cities. Most of those cities are cities that in case of war are targeted. And more and more and more, the issues that need to be resolved, both from a health, social, construction perspective, exist in cities, and the cities are being starved of the resources to do that in order to feed a military-industrial complex. And I think there's the possibility around a civic unity of beginning to push back. The statement that was made by the U.S. Mayor's Congress on nuclear weapons non-proliferation treaty, those things are important. And I think as cities we can begin to drive a national agenda for peace and say, you know, the Cold War is over, it's time not to start another war. The Fourth World War, as the Bush administration has declared it. It's time to begin to build a framework for peace and take the resources that we have to better humankind.
So what are some of the peace issues that you're working on in Vancouver?
I chair the Peace and Justice Committee of the City of Vancouver. We've come out very strongly in opposition to Star Wars. We've led a campaign nationally on that, and I think there are now some 80 Canadian cities that have signed on to that. It forced the incoming Prime Minister to put that question on his website, and he put it on, and the response was 87% of the population was opposed to Canada participating.
What's the role of Canada right now in this?
Well, Canada is sort of being brought into the discussions because of their membership in NORAD. In other words, North American Air Defense, the theory is that the missile shield is part of that. And so it's very hard to be part of NORAD and part of a North American air defense and not enter into the discussions about what role this would play in air defense. But the Canadian public is very, very clearly opposed. We've got a minority government nationally right now where the balance of power is held by a social democratic or democratic socialist party. You know, quite frankly, it is an issue that will bring down the government if they pursue it, and they know it.
That was David Cadman, Deputy Mayor of the City of Vancouver, British Columbia, and Delegate to the 17th Annual Assembly of the International Association of Peace Messenger Cities. He can be contacted via email at cityforpeace@peaceandjustice.ca. With memories of the 2000 Florida election debacle fresh in the minds of millions of voters across the nation, a new coalition of groups are making preparations to ensure that all citizens eligible to vote are able to cast ballots and have their votes counted in this November's presidential election. The Election Protection Coalition is made up of 60 organizations and includes the AFL-CIO, the NAACP, People for the American Way, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and the League of United Latin American Citizens. The coalition is confronting many of the same problems that plagued the 2000 election, which threatened the legitimacy of this year's vote. Efforts are now underway to challenge systemic voter suppression and intimidation aimed at people of color and correct flawed voting machinery, badly designed ballots, and suspect methods of collecting absentee ballots. The infamous list of convicted felons used in Florida to improperly disenfranchise tens of thousands of voters during the 2000 election was resurrected again this year by officials in Governor Jeb Bush's administration, but later scrapped after court challenges. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sharon Lettman, Deputy Field Director with People for the American Way based in Tallahassee, who discusses the defects remaining to be overcome in Florida and the preparations being made across the nation to ensure that every vote is counted in November's election.
We have a national movement going on right now. In Florida, we just focused on the primary election. That was August 31st, and we did a dry run of our National Election Protection Project with our coalition partners from around the country. We focused on five counties. We did a targeted sample in precincts to see the readiness of Florida for the upcoming election. But we plan on deploying over 25,000 volunteers nationwide and reaching over 3,500 polling sites with our legal hotline as we recruit over 6,000 lawyers for Election Day.
So what are you most concerned about in terms of the election? I mean, there were multiple failures of systems and certainly some conscious effort to suppress the vote in Florida itself that I think, you know, most people listening, most Americans are familiar with, the butterfly ballot, the felons list, which I think is a lot less known. But what are some of the things that you're focusing on as you take on this crusade to make sure that our votes are counted?
One of the earlier issues we took on was the felon list again for 2004. Believe it or not, they were sued from the 99 list. They lost the lawsuit. We won. They had all these new criteria to come out with, and they came out with a new felon list in 2004. And once again, luckily for them, they didn't have to get sued because they had to throw it out because they had just as many egregious problems with the felon list they attempted to use for 2004 as they used in 2000. And yet to also find out that after being sued and lost the lawsuit, that they still have not restored all the names from 2000. And the 2000 list had just as many egregious errors on it in a new form and fashion that they were called on, that CNN sued them, other media outlets from across the country did investigations, including ourselves, that found more persons on the list who were already cleared through the clemency process, as well as innocent persons who had never been convicted of any type of felony. So that's just one of the many egregious issues that are going on today. We also just sued them over the manual recount issue. They attempted to put touchscreen machines into administrative law and didn't clear the legislature to say that there was not going to be any manual recount necessary for touchscreen machines, even though their touchscreen machines have no audit trail. And they tried to change it through administrative law. We sued them. The judge ruled in our favor and threw out the process to say you absolutely must have a manual recount in place, and they have yet to identify the process in which they'll go about manual recount.
Now, you're focused on Florida, of course, because that was the flashpoint for all the big issues that resulted in what many still feel was an illegitimate election of a president back in 2000. But there are other operations across the country in every other state. Is that right?
Absolutely. We're actually going to have 17 states that are going to have ground operations. First and foremost, Election Protection Coalition is a nonpartisan coalition, and People for the American Way Foundation is just one of many organizations that are on the front line working towards making sure that every citizen that has the right to vote has the opportunity to vote, that their vote is cast and counted, and that they are free of any intimidations or obstacles that may confront them that would hinder their freedom of voting.
we've been reading about in Bob Herbert's column in the New York Times and other places about, you know, really blatant comments about Republicans in particular and their goal of suppressing the black vote, as John Papa George talked about in the state of Michigan, where he wanted to suppress the Detroit predominantly black, predominantly Democratic vote there. But there's other incidents that we've also been reading about in Florida where state police are going into the homes, particularly of older African-Americans, questioning them about absentee ballots they may have filled out. Maybe you could detail some of the concerns here about efforts to suppress the vote or intimidate voters.
Voter suppression has a tremendous history that has been affected by all parties, and our issue more so is the citizen and making sure that they know the systemic issues that society has been a victim of and that they are equipped with the knowledge of things that they should be looking out for, like traffic stops on election day, like checkpoints, like mass movements of infiltration on the ground by covert groups that are challenging people as to whether or not they have their ID on election day and forcing them to show it. You have no responsibility to anybody until you walk into the polling place to show your ID or to participate in the process of voting.
Is the intimidation tactics, if that's what they are, is that working to dissuade people from becoming involved in the process or getting involved in going to the polls this year?
I mean, African Americans as a whole suffered for over 400 years just to fight for their freedom. We cannot let 4 years disenfranchise our voice and our vote for what our forefathers and foremothers fought so hard for. There are a million ways to steal the election. I think there's going to be a million attempts at doing so. But I think the more that we raise the public awareness, the more that we have people at the polls, the more that we're in the system's face saying the system, we will not allow our voice and our vote to be robbed, that we've got to combat it. Freedom isn't free. Freedom is not free. And this country has taught us time and time again that you've got to stand up and be vocal and demand your rights to be fair and equal. If it comes to fighting for my democracy, then I'm willing to be on the front line every day.
That was Sharon Lettman, Deputy Field Director with People for the American Way, who was working with the Election Protection Coalition. To get more information or to report election irregularities, call 1-866-OUR-VOTE, toll-free, or visit the coalition's website at www.electionprotection2004.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.